And Radio Derb is on the air. Greetings, listeners, from your iconoclastically genial host, John Derbyshire. The fog of battle surrounding the November 3rd election has cleared somewhat, but there are still uncertainties about the consequences. Plainly, there was much more than the usual amount of skullduggery in the registering and counting of votes. And it all seems to have favoured Joe Biden. Whether much of it can be dealt with in the courts, and whether, if it can, the judgments will be enough to swing the result back to Trump, these are open questions as I come to the mic here. As best I can predict, we'll be looking at a Joe Biden inauguration in January. It's not certain, and I'm glad the president and his team are fighting for what's right. All strength to them. It's probable, though, and I base my commentary on that. So, what shall we get from a Biden administration? Well, one thing we're sure to get is open borders. As VDay.com's correspondent Jack Dalton noted on Thursday, a Biden administration will go full-bore open borders, jumping to the whips cracked by cheap labour business lobbies and anti-white ethnic grievance activists. The dribble of reforms and improvements made by the Trump administration's executive orders will all be cancelled. If we're lucky, the new stretches of border wall will not be dynamited, but no more will be built. The Biden people are perfectly open about their intentions. CBS News ran a report on Tuesday, presumably sourced from Biden campaign insiders, spelling it all out. The so-called Dreamers, that's illegal aliens who claim to have been brought here as children, the Dreamers will get full resident alien status, leading to citizenship. The 11 or 20 or 30 million non-Dreamer illegal aliens living here, nobody really knows the number, will also be given permanent residence, likewise leading to citizenship. There will be a 100-day freeze on a deportation of illegals. Illegals not targeted by ICE, that is, they're just here illegally, but they aren't suspected of any other criminality, they won't be arrested. The policy of requiring non-Mexican asylum seekers to wait in Mexico while their cases are decided will end. The ban on entry from terrorist-friendly nations will end. The Trump administration has negotiated agreements with Guatemala, El Salvador, and Honduras that allow us to send rejected asylum seekers to those countries to argue their cases. The Biden administration will pull out of those agreements. The public charge rules that this administration has implemented to deny permanent residence to aliens who are using or likely to use government benefits, those rules will be scrapped. The limits on guest worker visas imposed this spring will be lifted. In an ongoing pandemic with widespread unemployment, the gates will be opened to cheap foreign workers. There will be huge increases in the numbers of so-called refugees. Aliens given temporary protected status, often decades ago, because of some crisis in their home countries, will not be forced to leave next March, as a court said they should be. So temporary will not, after all, mean temporary. It will mean permanent. And so on. It's all deeply disheartening. Are there any shafts of light in the gloom? I'll go looking for some. New segment. As I said, Biden's victory is very disheartening to those of us at VDare.com and like-minded groups who have been toiling away for years, for decades now, to bring the true facts about immigration to public attention, to expose the carefully concocted blend of misty sentimentality and cold cash racketeering that guided the immigration policy of presidents from LBJ to Barack Obama. We advocate for a rational immigration policy, one to the advantage of American citizens in general, just as Japan's immigration policy is designed for the advantage of Japanese citizens, just as Israel's immigration policy is designed for the advantage of Israeli citizens. It can be done, as those nations have shown. Immigration is not some kind of natural force against which resistance is futile or immoral. It's just a policy, like tax rates, farm price supports, or how many aircraft carriers we need. Donald Trump was the first president in 60 years who seemed to understand that. Now we're back to sentimentality and racketeering, to the delight of the Koch brothers, the Chamber of Commerce, Silicon Valley billionaires, and the refugee resettlement scammers, but to the further impoverishment of the American middle class. And while Trump has done much with executive actions and appeals to the courts, we shouldn't let him off the hook for his administration's failures. We've heard a lot about his problems finding staffers who are on board with his policies. Yet, when capable, reliable people were available, I'm thinking of Kris Kobach, Steve King, Jeff Sessions, when they were available, they were discarded and humiliated by Trump. And the jobs they should have had were given to mediocrities and anti-Trumpers. Above all, there was that wasted 2 years when Trump's party controlled Congress. Real immigration reform needs legislation. Legislation needs congressional action. To be sure, Mitch McConnell and Paul Ryan were much more interested in feeding their business lobby donors with cheap foreign labour and virtue signalling their anti-racist piety than they were in enacting Trump's policies. But with energy, determination, and the negotiating skills he boasts of, Trump might have gotten something done. He didn't even try. The future, however, isn't completely dark. Quote from that CBS report on Biden's plans, quote, "While Mr. Biden's team will have the legal authority to overturn Mr. Trump's policies, Doris Meissner, a former commissioner of the now defunct Immigration and Naturalization Service, said it will not be an easy endeavor, given bureaucratic requirements, the ongoing COVID-19 emergency, and the volume of changes implemented over the past 4 years." In a quote from her, The Trump administration had an extraordinary preoccupation with immigration issues, and they invested an enormous amount of attention and single-minded focus on immigration. An administration that wants to undo those changes would have to devote a similar amount of time and effort. End in a quote, end quote. If the lady is right, Trump's actions on immigration won't all be swept away with a stroke of the pen. Some of them may survive. And then there's the Biden rush. American voters may not give immigration the attention it deserves, but elsewhere in the world, interest is very keen. Hundreds of millions of people in crap hole countries worldwide have been watching this recent election intensely. They believe a Biden administration will throw the borders wide open, and they are packing their bags to make their way to those open borders. If this develops into a real human tide, as it well might, immigration will be front and center of the national consciousness, with strong public pressure to reimpose controls. Numbers are of the essence, said the great British immigration patriot Enoch Powell. Indeed they are. But the sheer stupendous numbers of people who want to come and live in America is the hardest thing to get across to ordinary voters. With the encouragement of Biden and his people, those numbers may be clearly visible on our TV screens a few months from now, or perhaps in the run-up to the 2022 midterms. This could get interesting. As a footnote to that, having mentioned Enoch Powell there, while immediate prospects for the USA are dark, for Britain and Western Europe, the longer-term prospects are way darker. In Britain's case, Brexit is a factor. Remember Brexit? In 2016, the Brits voted to leave the European Union. That was one of the two great populist nationalist events of that year, the other, of course, being the election of Donald Trump. 3.5 years of fussing and fudging followed, until at last on January 31st this year, Britain did formally leave the EU. Key word there, formally. Britain's out of the EU, but still subject to EU laws and regulations until the end of this year, December 31st. This 11-month span, from January 31st to December 31st, is the so-called transition period, when details of future trade, customs, travel rules, and yes, immigration, are worked out. So, 7 weeks from now, Britain will be really, truly, at last, finally, no more fudging, honest engine, out of the EU. What will Britain's immigration rules then look like? Incredibly, with severe lockdowns leading to soaring unemployment, with illegal immigration at levels that an independent inspector has told the government are, quote, unsustainable, end quote, and with widespread housing shortages, incredibly, the government wants to relax immigration controls. You ready for the punchline? Britain's current ruling party is the Conservative Party. The post-Brexit immigration rules were published 3 weeks ago. The changes that have gotten the most attention relate to work permits for skilled workers, like our own H-1B visas. The cap on total numbers has been removed. Eligible skill levels have been lowered. The minimum salary on offer has been reduced. These post-Brexit rules are a cheapskate employer's wet dream. And, of course, a middle-class British worker's nightmare. Last year, here on Radio Derb, I poo-pooed the idea that Prime Minister Boris Johnson had any kind of a clue on the national question. I didn't know the half of it. National question-wise, this guy is worse than Tony Blair. In Western Europe, as in the English Channel, the invasion quietly accelerates. Less than 100 miles off the coast of West Africa lie the Canary Islands, which are Spanish territory. Their being Spanish means that an African who wants to live in Europe just has to cross that few miles of sea to the Canaries. So far this year, 11,000 Africans have done so. Just last weekend, Saturday and Sunday, 2,000 Africans on 45 boats landed on the islands. The authorities have had to put them up in hotels, a thing the British have also had to resort to with illegal aliens crossing the channel. There is no strong will in Britain or Western Europe to do anything about this. The citizens of these countries seem determined on national suicide. Meanwhile, living conditions in Africa get worse. Latest news, civil war is breaking out in Ethiopia. President Trump fired his defense secretary on Monday. This was Mark Esper, who had held the job since July last year. Prior to joining the administration 3 years ago, Esper was a lobbyist for big defence contractors. Did Trump know that when he appointed him? If you get elected president on an America First platform, why would you hire in a frontman for the military-industrial complex and then promote him to your cabinet? Just another Trump administration mystery that we'll have to wait for the memoirs to clarify. Anyway, Trump fired Esper on Monday. Major areas of discord seem to have been: one, Esper opposed using regular troops against the anarchist mobs trashing our cities this summer, and two, Esper wants to remove the names of Confederate leaders from military bases. So, good riddance to another lousy hire. Don't let the door hit you, pal. Esper's replacement is Christopher Miller, a counter-terrorism expert who won his credentials through 30 years in special ops, actually fighting terrorists. That's good work, but it's kind of ground level. For some loftier geostrategic perspective, Acting Defense Secretary Miller has hired in as senior advisor retired Army Colonel Douglas McGregor. That's good news. Or it would be if this wasn't so late in the game. McGregor is on record as believing a lot of what Radio Derb believes. Pull our troops out of Afghanistan and close the embassy in Kabul. We have zero national interest in Syria, and we should have nothing to do with the place. Defending South Korea is a job for the South Koreans, not for the United States. They have twice the population of North Korea and 50 times the GDP. Let them take care of their own defences. Oh, also, McGregor thinks that European countries have been too welcoming to, his actual words, Muslim invaders. And so on. That has gotten Colonel McGregor tagged as divisive and iconoclastic by the media. Another good sign. Divisive? I'm all for dividing off lobbyists for defence contractors and Middle East potentates from Americans who just want their country secure and prosperous and minding its own business. I should add that Colonel McGregor's boldest iconoclasm is his desire to get rid of the US Marine Corps. Quote from him on that. The Marines, as currently organised and equipped, are about as relevant as the Army's horse cavalry in the 1930s. End quote. That is not as outrageously iconoclastic as it sounds. Presidents Truman and Eisenhower both favoured scrapping the Marine Corps. Both of them were, though, like Colonel McGregor, Army veterans. Sharing a house as I do with another Army veteran, I can testify that some Army guys have issues with the Marines. I'll just leave it at that and return to my main theme, which was what? Oh yes, sensible new policies on our world policeman role. Remember that this, along with patriotic immigration reform, these were the two issues that, more than any others, got Trump elected in 2016. The Clinton-Bush-Obama policies of invade the world, invite the world, were out of favour with a huge segment of the voting population. Trump promised to end them. In the event, he didn't do much either of de-invading or de-inviting. The things he did do on immigration, Biden has promised to undo. Will the same apply to policing the world? Will Biden send our troops back out policing after Trump has brought them home, assuming he can? I guess we'll find out. Here's an old story from my Liverpool days. For background, I need to explain that mid-20th century Liverpool had two First Division football teams. That's soccer, of course. Two teams named Liverpool City and Everton. Now, Liverpool was almost as much an Irish city as an English one. It's just across the water from Ireland, so there was considerable Irish influence. That included sectarianism, strong Protestant and Catholic identities. One manifestation of that was in football. Liverpool City and its supporters skewed heavily Protestant. Everton were for the Catholics. Okay, the story. One year, a derby was played. Liverpool against Everton. The result was a win for Liverpool. On a bus taking supporters home after the game, There was a glum little group of Everton supporters tasting the ashes of defeat. One of them was heard to say, "Sure, there'll be some sad faces in the Vatican tonight." For some reason, I had that story on my mind last weekend when the media declared that Trump had lost the election. The phrase that my inner cynic came up with was, "Sure, there'll be some sad faces in the Kremlin tonight." I hastened to explain that wasn't me thinking that. It was me guessing at what the anti-Trump establishment were all thinking. Hadn't they been telling us for 5 years that Trump was Vladimir Putin's glove puppet? So it would make sense for them to believe that Trump's loss would be Putin's loss. So, yes, according to them, there should be some sad faces in the Kremlin. I dismissed those thoughts as low and facetious. Surely establishment progressives aren't that stupid. Well, I dismissed too soon. Here's a progressive tweeter labelled Trump's Zombieland, November 11th, responding to the news about Colonel McGregor's appointment and his wish to bring the troops home. Tweet: "Putin has called in all of Trump's carrot and stick IOUs. Trump has 2 months to make good on his end. An America in shambles was a bonus for Putin. Giving Russia the Middle East was the payday that Putin bargained for." What do you think all those Pentagon firings are about? End tweet. That is actually really the establishment mindset. Putin put Trump in power by hacking the 2016 election. The Russians have kept him in power by similar shady means, and he's been obediently doing their bidding. Now they're calling in their IOUs. Their endgame is to replace our influence in the Middle East with theirs. Leaving aside that there is no evidence Russian hacking had any significant effect in 2016, and that the Trump administration has done Putin no favours by, for example, lifting the sanctions that followed the 2014 annexation of the Crimea, leaving all that aside, I wish someone in the establishment would explain a few things they have never bothered to explain. Like, number one, why is influence in the Middle East such a big prize? We don't even need their oil anymore. Number two, is chasing Muslim fanatics around the Hindu Kush for 20 years really a good way to spend our national resources and the lives of our soldiers? Number three, Russia's population is less than half of ours and declining. That's spread across a land area close to twice of ours. They have no economy to speak of, other than pulling oil and gas out of the ground. Their society is a swamp of crime, corruption, and alcoholism. I should fear Russia as a threat or a rival to the USA? Why? Number four, if it's loud, open, and plausible rivalry I should worry about, doesn't China outweigh Russia by a factor of at least 10? If that tweeter or some other establishment shill wants to address those questions, I'm all ears. Here's an item from, yes, Turkmenistan. You know how your state has a state song, a state bird, a state flower, and so on? Well, Turkmenistan has a national dog, the Alabey. Described here as a home-bred Turkmen variety of the Central Asian shepherd dog. It's quite a handsome critter, the Alabey. Strong and fearless, independent, freedom-loving and confident, says this website I'm looking at. Body heavy, huge, balanced and muscular. Weight 40 to 80 pounds. That's a big dog. No surprise, given all that, to learn that Turkmenistan's strong, fearless, balanced and muscular president, Gurbanguly Berdimuhamedov, patron and friend of Radio Derb, is also a big fan of the Alabey. Last year, he wrote a book about it, to unanimous acclaim from Turkmenistan's literary critics. Well, on Tuesday last, President Gurbanguly Berdimuhamedov accorded the breed a further honour, unveiling a golden, well, actually, of course, gilt, a gilt statue of an Alabey in the centre of the Turkmen capital, Ashgabat. The statue is hard to miss. It's 19 feet high, on top of a plinth 30 feet high, in a residential area of the city inhabited by government workers. The BBC, reporting on this in its usual snooty style, still burning with resentment at the loss of Britain's empire, the BBC honked that honk. Despite the grandeur of the statue, much of Turkmenistan's population is impoverished. The country is ranked one of the least free in the world by press freedom organisation RSF, just one place above North Korea. End honk. Yeah, right, Sir Humphrey. Whatever. Here's one statue that, unlike yours and ours, won't be daubed with anarchist slogans or pulled off its plinth by a jeering mob. Not while President Gurbanguly Berdimuhamedov is there to protect it. Long live President Gurbanguly Berdimuhamedov. Long live the noble Republic of Turkmenistan. Derbyshire, as well as being the surname of your genial host, Derbyshire is also the name of an English county, one of the 39 historic counties in the mother country. It's a bit of a backwater, rural and hilly, no great centres of power, wealth or influence, and not much industry. The busier, smokier counties to its north and west regard Derbyshire folk as gap-toothed bumpkins. Derbyshire born, Derbyshire bred, strong in the arm, weak in the head. I hasten to say that other than sharing its name, I have nothing to do with Derbyshire, and I have no gaps in my teeth. I have only been in Derbyshire twice, briefly on business both times. That doesn't stop Radio Derb listeners sending me news items about Derbyshire, usually items that reinforce the bumpkin stereotype. Here's one such. This is a story from BBC News, November 7th. Headline: Belper's Mass Moo returns for second lockdown. Belper is a small town a few miles north of Derby. There was a coronavirus lockdown there from March to June. To keep up their spirits, the townspeople organised a daily moo. That's moo as in the sound made by a cow. At 6:30 every evening, they would stand on their doorsteps or lean out of their windows and moo for 2 minutes. Quote from the BBC story. Back in April, resident Isabel Kennedy said the moo had become, in a quote, the highlight of my day. And in a quote, end quote. Are you getting the impression that not a lot happens in Belper? The lockdown was suspended in June as the pandemic ebbed. Now the virus is coming back and another lockdown has been ordered. So the good people of Belper are warming up to resume their daily moo. That's the latest moos from Derbyshire. And now, our closing miscellany of brief items. Imprimis. Contemplating President Trump's defeat, Hillary Clinton told an interviewer that, quote, I am feeling better than I have felt in 4 years, end quote. Can you imagine taking politics so seriously? You've been out of sorts for 4 years over losing a race? Well, if you're female, you probably can. As I've noted before, quote from me, women take things a whole lot more personally than men do, end quote. I do understand, though, how galling it must be for Mrs. Clinton, after devoting all those years to being some guy's wife, with opinions out of the Wellesley College Progressive Students Handbook, 1968 edition, how galling it must have been to lose an election to a political nobody out of right field. A guy who made his fortune in, business. I'm glad you're feeling better, Hillary. Item. I mentioned in the podcast 3 weeks ago the case of Jeffrey Toobin, star writer at New Yorker magazine. Toobin was caught jerking the gherkin when he thought he was off camera on a Zoom conference. The magazine suspended him, pending an investigation. Wednesday this week, the New Yorker announced the investigation was complete and Toobin had been fired. It's a sad story, but not all that sad. I'm here to assure Mr. Toobin that getting dumped by a prestigious magazine is not the end of the world. He's a smart guy and only 60 years old, a spring chicken. If he can't get work in the magazine business, he's still young enough to adapt and change careers. A guy as capable as Toobin should be able to turn his hand to anything. Item. Very little remains of my high school French. I only did 1 year of it, then I switched to German as being more mathy and sciencey. I can still construe La plume de ma tante et sur le bureau de mon oncle, but beyond that, all is mystery. I therefore had to resort to Google Translate for this one. Je ne lance pas mes enfants par-dessus le portail. That, according to Google, means I don't throw my children over the gate. The story here concerns Trillade Primary School in Avignon, southern France. The school is surrounded by a 6-foot fence with a 6-foot gate in it. At precisely 8:30 a.m., the gate is closed and locked. Local parents who missed the deadline had been throwing their kids over the gate into the schoolyard. So, to discourage this practice, the school has posted a big sign outside saying, Je ne lance pas mes enfants par-dessus le portail. I think I did the right thing switching to German. Ich werfe meine Kinder nicht über das Tor. Item. From even further afield, here is a once proud nation of pioneers, adventurers, yeoman farmers and, well, okay, convicts, all bending over and grabbing their ankles in self-abasement at the demand of social activists. Yes, this is Australia. The postal service down there is running a campaign to get people writing the Aboriginal names of cities and districts when they address a letter or a parcel. So, instead of addressing your Christmas card to Sydney, you write it as Eora. Melbourne should be Woiwurrung. For Brisbane, you should write Yugara. And so on. Aboriginal activist Rachel MacPhail, who, by the way, looks about as Aboriginal as I do, Ms. MacPhail started the campaign on social media in August, telling us that Aboriginal people had lived in Australia for at least 60,000 years. Well, that's nice. In all those 60,000 years, however, Aborigines never developed any kind of writing system. So, by imposing our Latin alphabet on their precious place names, aren't they committing an act of cultural appropriation? Come to think of it, Aborigines never, in all those 60,000 years, they never developed a postal service. Nor did they develop agriculture, enabling their people to feed themselves up to the size of Ms. MacPhail, who I would judge weighs north of 300 pounds. These things were all gifts of the white man. You're welcome, ma'am. That's it, ladies and gents. Thank you for listening, and particular thanks in this week of Veterans Day to any veterans among the Radio Derb listenership. As is customary at this time of year, I shall play us out with what is, in my opinion, the loveliest of all hymns appropriate to Veterans Day. Or, as I was brought up to call it, Remembrance Day. Here is the Chapel Choir of the Royal Hospital, Chelsea, singing, O Valiant Hearts. There will be more from Radio Derb next week.